Thank you for being present this evening at the second event of the Jefferson Society Speaker Series, Exploring Our World. Before I introduce this evening's speaker, I would like to say a word of thanks to our sponsors. The Office of the Vice President of Research and Graduate Studies has agreed to be our chief partner by sponsoring this year's speaker series. UVA Outreach also has provided us with the opportunity to podcast these events, and the content will be available shortly on both the Society website via digital stream and podcast, and on the UVA podcast. The UVA chapter of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics has also sponsored this evening's event. Without the help of these organizations, our programs for this semester would be impossible. My thanks goes out to you. This evening's speaker is Dr. Seth Shostak. Seth is the senior astronomer at the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, or SETI, Institute, a private, nonprofit research center that conducts various scientific studies to try to answer the question of whether life exists outside of this Earth. He hosts a weekly radio show from the SETI Institute called Are We Alone, a forum for him to interview scientists on the cutting edge of space research and travel. He's published numerous articles and 3 books with the intent of helping make complex but relevant scientific ideas about astronomy and space travel accessible to a lay audience. We're lucky to have such a unique and distinguished guest of the Society tonight. I'd like everyone here to stand and join me in applauding our speaker, Seth Shostak.
Well, I certainly want to thank the Jefferson Society and the other co-sponsors for bringing me all the way to lovely Charlottesville. I came from California, in case you know how far away that is. So they really went to some trouble to bring me here. And I was sort of dismayed to notice that you applauded before my talk, which is probably something you will soon regret. Anyhow, I had assumed that I was going to be showing you PowerPoint slides, the usual deal. And I learned from Amro this afternoon that that is considered déclassé. That is not in keeping with the usual procedures here at the Jefferson Society. So my talk will be somewhat ad hoc. But then again, that isn't to say it'll be any worse than it would have been otherwise. What I want to talk to you a little bit about today, or tonight, this evening, whatever it is indeed my day job, which is looking for extraterrestrials. And actually, before I get into that, maybe I should ask, how many of you think that there actually are intelligent beings beyond Earth? I'm just sort of curious. And how many of you think, no, probably not? Okay, well, you're the people I want to talk to later. I will endeavor to leave some Q&A time at the end of my talk so you can grill me like a cheese sandwich and ask me those questions that you know I'm deliberately avoiding. Okay, well, let me just say to begin with that I think that you are actually a very fortunate generation. I mean, there have been 10,000 generations of Homo sapiens before you, so you're generation 10,001. And I think that you're living in a rather special time. And of course, I suspect that every generation would have said something similar. We're always living in a special time. But I think that there are 3 things that are going to happen in the 21st century that are going to be actually highly radical, really, in defining what the role of Homo sapiens will be in the 21st century, or 22nd century, I guess it is now. To begin with, we're finally understanding biology, okay? I mean, we've sequenced the human genome. We've sequenced the genomes of some other living things. We're finally beginning to understand biology. And, of course, this will have immediate benefit in terms of the treatment of disease and stuff like that. But, of course, we're going to start tinkering with it rather quickly, I think, as well. And you may think, well, I don't like that idea. And maybe you don't like that idea. But I think it's going to be hard to stop. Designer babies are usually the issue that people bring up right away. I don't want a designer baby, you know. Well, look. If you're about to have a kid and, you know, the physician says, you know, for $50 more, your kid could have the musical talent of Elton John. You want to sign on for that or not, right? And you might say, well, okay, $50. And say, now, could be, you know, Richard Greer in terms of appearance or maybe Nicole Kidman. That's another $35. You know, interested? Not interested. And you might check that box, too. So I think that, you know, irrespective of whether you think it's a good idea or not, it's going to happen, and that's going to change us. In particular, the way it'll change us, it'll mean that your kids are no longer quite so genetically related to you, and that may have obvious consequences. So that's one thing. The second thing that's going to happen, I think, is that we're going to succeed with, for example, the SETI Enterprise and learn that you're not the cleverest things in the galaxy, or for that matter, the universe, as many of my neighbors seem to think they are. Okay. So that'll be the subject of the talk, but and that will have consequences, too. Maybe I can get into some of those. The third thing, which I left for last only because I think it's probably the most profound thing that's going to happen in this century, is the development of machine intelligence, right? Thinking machines. Now, you're in favor of it, right? Okay, well, you're thinking, well, I can do my homework. There's something in the Silicon Valley. Sorry, and that's where I live, by the way, the Silicon Valley. It's just south of San Francisco, and it's hardly a valley, but anyhow. And there's not much silicon in it anymore either, now that I think about it, except in the ground. The Silicon Valley, there's a rule in the Silicon Valley called Moore's Law. This is named after Gordon Moore. Gordon Moore is one of the co-founders of Intel Corporation. And he noted in the 1960s, so it's been a while now, he noted that every 18 months, on average, the amount of, the number of transistors you could get on a chip per dollar doubled. Now, what this really means is that the speed of a computer that you can buy for a given price doubles every 18 months. You know this is true, right? Because every couple of years, you got to throw out whatever machines you had and buy new ones. Okay. Now, this has been true for decades, and it's going to be true for at least another couple of decades. After that, the predictions are a little unclear. But what that means is that today, for $1,000, you can buy a computer that has the compute power of a lizard. Now, you might say, well, that's not terribly interesting unless you're into lizards, right? And they don't think, right? Machines don't think, but by the year 2020, your desktop computer will have the same computational capability as a human brain. It isn't to say that it can think. That depends on the software. But if the software keeps pace with the hardware, right, at that point, the machine is more capable than you are. And I don't know what you do there. My personal inclination is simply turn the keyboard around. You type. Whatever. I made this point, actually, up at the University of Washington in Seattle a year or two ago, and talking about thinking machines. And one of the undergrads raised his hand and said, but if we make machines that are smarter than we are, won't they kill us? And I thought that was just the natural optimism of youth, you know? But I replied, I'm not quite sure what I said, but it was something along the lines of, well, look, I've got some goldfish at home, and I'm smarter than they are, but I don't wake up in the morning and think, I'm going to kill those guys. I mean, it just never occurs to me. I give them some food and leave for the office. So it isn't clear to me that just because you have machines that are smarter than we are that they're going to kill us. They may turn us into their pets. It's unclear what happens, but we've never had that situation, at least not for the last 10,000 generations. 2 million years ago, the smartest thing on planet Earth was one of the dolphins, actually, in terms of, insofar as you can measure the IQ of things that are gone. But that was 2 million years ago. But for the last, couple of 100,000 years, Homo sapiens has been the smartest thing on the planet, and you've gotten used to that idea. Let's hear it for Homo sapiens, right? Okay, anyhow, so those are the three things that are going to happen, I think, in the 21st century, in this century, and you're the generation that's going to see it happen. So I don't know what it's all going to mean, but let me get into the subject here of life in space. Is there life in space? The answer to that is easy. We don't know. We actually don't know. We haven't found a single critter, a single microbe that is uncontestably from someplace beyond Earth. Not even a dead one, right? Now, some of you, you're all relatively young, but some of you may remember 1996. The biggest science news story of 1996 was a little hunk of rock. It was a meteorite that some NASA scientists had pulled off the ice down in Antarctica. And by the way, 90% of all meteorites are now found in Antarctica. You may wonder about that. You may figure, what are the meteors doing this consciously? Here comes a meteor headed for Earth. Well, where am I going to land? Is it going to be, Passaic, New Jersey, maybe Crozet? No, I think I'll go to Antarctica, right? Well, they don't do that. They land everywhere. The thing is that another rock in Crozet is not something you're going to notice. But a rock that's in Antarctica is going to be on top of the ice. And anything on top of the ice must have come from the sky, because all the rock in Antarctica is underneath the ice. So it's very easy to recognize them. They also get shoved around by the glaciers and things like that. So they find lots of these things. And this particular one was a little different. There are only a couple of dozen that are known to have this particular property, namely that it was kicked off Mars. It's a piece of Mars right here on Earth. And you may wonder how they know it's from Mars. And the answer that NASA will tell you is that there's a little brass plate on the bottom that says made on Mars, so you can tell. Anyhow, there's very little controversy about that. It's definitely from Mars. I can tell you later if you really want to know why. But that's not the controversy. The controversy was they opened it up, and you may remember they made photomicrographs of what was inside, and they saw these little squiggles, that looked like dead microbes. And for four days running in the New York Times, the top story in fonts that are so large that they're never in the drop-down menus. These were big fonts. It said, NASA claims to have found dead microbes from Mars. Martians. Now, these weren't little green guys that were going to invade the planet or anything, right? And Stephen Jay Gould wrote an op-ed piece in the paper in which he said, we are not amused, or we are not impressed anyhow, because he said, look, finding dead pond scum on Mars does not get me excited. I got live pond scum at home in my bathtub. Why do I care about dead pond scum on Mars? And he missed the point, surprisingly. I was surprised. He missed the point. The point is, if you find pond scum on Mars, even dead, and this pond scum would have been dead about 4 billion years, so it's well and truly dead, that tells you something very important. Because that tells you, hey, look, life's not a miracle. Right? This next rock out, this next planet out, Mars, also had life. It's sort of like, what's it like? It's sort of like being a termite coming out of your termite mound, looking around, well, we've got a pretty good mound here, and I figure we're the only termites on the planet. And you might think that until you look 50 feet away and see another termite mound, and then you decide maybe we're not the only termites on the planet. Okay. Well, it was the same. It would be completely analogous here, right? Unless somehow Mars had infected the Earth, which is a possibility, but there's no evidence of that. So if you find life on the next planet out, that means that life must be as common in the universe as cheap motels, right? Must be everywhere. Okay? And that would be a very profound thing, to know that biology is not so special. Doesn't mean you're not special, but that at least biology is not special. Well, unfortunately, it all turned out to be controversial. But so people don't believe it. I mean, the guys who wrote the paper still believe it, but they're in a decided minority. So the bottom line is still, we don't have any compelling evidence for any life beyond this here planet. So, why do you think that there is some? Well, the bottom line is you only think that there is some because there's just a lot of real estate. I don't know how many of you saw the movie Contact with Jodie. Yes. Yeah. Did you like that one? Well, yeah. Yeah, that was somewhat based on the work of the SETI Institute where I work. And several of the characters, including the Jodie Foster character, are based on real-life people who are not quite as aesthetically pleasing as the ones in the movie, but okay. Certainly, everybody says, what about Matthew McConaughey? Does he work at the SETI Institute? No. That Matthew McConaughey actually didn't have much of a role in the film, but every time you say that in mixed audiences, the women all say, doesn't matter. So, anyhow, her argument for life in space was, well, if there isn't anything out there, then that would be a waste of space. A waste of space. Now, this is kind of the real estate, this is like God wouldn't have done that. And that's really a real estate developer theory of God, right? That if God makes all these galaxies up there and there's nobody in them, well, that's just a waste of space. I mean, what's the point, right? It's like looking at some of the, real estate around here. It's not developed. What a waste. Okay, so that is an argument, and that is the argument. There's a lot of space out there. The number of stars in our galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy, is on the order of several hundred billion. Several hundred billion. The number of galaxies you can see with a big telescope like Hubble is on the order of several hundred billion. So you can multiply those two numbers together in your head or on the back of the shirt of the guy in front of you, and you get a number that's 10 to the 22. That's 1 followed by 22 zeros. Right? That's 10,000 billion billion stars. That's more or less the number of grains of sand on all the beaches of North America. That's the number of stars. And thanks to the assiduous work of astronomers, most of who are in the San Francisco area, actually, we now know that probably the majority of those stars have planets. And they probably don't just have one planet each. So the number of, I think it's a safe thing to say, the number of planets in the part of the universe we can see, and there's a lot more universe that we can't, presumably, but the amount of planets in that part of the universe is about the same as the number of grains of sand on all the beaches of the Earth. Right? So for the half dozen of you here in the room who think, this is the only grain of sand where anything interesting is happening, you have to give these guys credit, because that's a very audacious point of view. That would make you very, very special. And if there's one thing that astronomy has taught us in the last 500 years, it was every time we thought we were special, we were wrong, right? So it's cautionary. Doesn't prove anything, but it's cautionary. Okay, well, how could we find life in space? How could we find intelligent life? Well, there are lots of ways to do it. In terms of, And in fact, there are kind of like three horses in the race to find life in space. I think one of these horses is going to come across the finish line in the next 20, well, by the year 2020, so the next dozen years or so. And so you'll see this happening. Okay, maybe some of you will do it. I don't know. The kinds of things you can do, one is you can just send rockets to Mars or some of the other bodies in our solar system that might have life and bring it back or bring something back that has some evidence that there's life up there. Right? Mars is not a bad bet. Mars has always been everybody's favorite inhabited planet, right? Because, you know, Mars, you can actually see the surface of Mars when you look through a small telescope like the one up here on, you know, Leander McCormick Observatory. You can actually see Mars. If you look at Venus, all you see is a white tennis ball because it's got this thick atmosphere and you can't see the surface. Mercury's far away, tiny little ball of rock. You don't see much there. Jupiter and Saturn, you can look at them through a pair of binoculars. You see something, but you're looking at the weather, right? You're not looking at the surface. And, you know, Uranus, Neptune, Pluto, they're far away. You couldn't see them at all. So Mars was always interesting, even in the Victorian times, because you could see the surface, and it kind of looked like the Earth, right? At the time that TJ was talking about, you know, putting stars on the inside of the dome here, as he was talking about, actually, because he was interested in astronomy, there were astronomers in Europe who were talking about the Martians as if there were Martians. Even well into the 20th century, the idea of Martians, of course, was very commonplace. And in 1938, you remember the War of the Worlds broadcast. This was Orson Welles. He makes this, you know, Halloween night broadcast, and he says over and over again, this is just fiction, but, you know, a lot of people went nonlinear and left their homes. One guy said, I'm glad they're here because they'll take out my mother-in-law. You know, it was kind of a phenomenon. So Martians have had a long run. There may be Martians, but if there are Martians, you'll need a microscope to see them. They're not going to invade the Earth, right? They're not the little green guys who are going to come here just to take our water. But there may be Martians. If you go to Mars, on the surface of Mars, it's pretty sterile. But if you go down maybe 100 feet or 200 feet, if you send Bruce Willis to Mars with a bunch of guys you can drill, you know, and you go down 100, 200 feet and bring up, you'll hit water, liquid water, that's pretty fairly known. And that water's been sitting there for billions of years, and it may be sterile, but it may have something in it. Okay? I mean, if you drill a hole here outside on the lawn, down a mile deep, a mile, maybe 2 miles deep, and you pull up the crud that's down there, the rock that's down there, you'll find microbes in it. And they're not living on photosynthesis, obviously, not a mile down, right? So life is very tough and can exist in some pretty tough environments. And so it's not inconceivable that if we could just go to Mars and drill 100 or 500 feet down, we might pull up some life. That's all something that could happen in the next dozen years or two dozen years. It all depends on somebody writing the check. It turns out there, aside from Mars, there's six other worlds in our solar system that I know about, that anybody knows about now, that might have liquid water. These are mostly moons of Jupiter and Saturn, and they're a little farther out. You might say, moon of Jupiter, who'd want to live there? Well, maybe you wouldn't want to live there, but if you're just a microbe and all you require is a little bit of water and some chemistry, then there's plenty of water. You know, typical moon of Jupiter, like Europa, it's not typical, but Europa in particular and two other moons have more water than the Earth does. A lot of liquid water. And it could just be sitting there completely sterile after 4 billion years. Could be. But on the other hand, all the ingredients for life are there. So unless life is a very, you know, improbable thing, then maybe some of these worlds have life. And once again, it would tell you that life isn't so improbable. One of the greatest arguments for life, by the way, being not so improbable, is the fact that it appeared very quickly on the Earth. Now, you all know about the dinos and all. You know, the dinos were around. Well, they got wiped out 65 million years ago. The story was in the Daily Progress when this rock slammed into the Yucatan and wiped out the dinos and about half of everything else, right? Okay, that was 65 million years ago when, by the way, the editorials in the Daily Progress were better. But, and the dinos were around for 150 million years. You could hope, actually. I've often complained that the dinos should have been wiped out earlier, right? Why do we have to wait for 150 million years of dino pleasure before we wipe them out? Because, you know, the dinos were interesting, all right, but they didn't do much. I mean, you go to the local library here, and you look under dino literature, you know, right? It's a fairly thin section. They didn't do much there. Had they been wiped out, maybe just a million years earlier would have been good enough for me, because then we would be a million years farther along now, and they'd have the cure for everything that you're worried about getting, and maybe eternal life and all that sort of stuff. Okay, well, anyhow, that's all recent history. Life actually got started. We have evidence for life on Earth as of last year. We have some evidence that goes back 3.5 billion years, right? That's a lot farther back than the dinos. That's 30 times farther back than the dinos. 3.5 billion years. Now, The Earth is only 4.5 billion years old. That's a number you should know for your next cocktail party when you need to make conversation. Did you know the Earth's 4.5 billion years old? So 4.5 billion years, but for the first almost 1 billion years of that, the Earth wasn't a great place to live because there are all these leftover pieces from making the solar systems, these big rocks that were slamming into the Earth all the time. One of them was about as big as Mars, a little bigger, and it produced the moon. I mean, you know, it was a tough environment with all these rocks raining down. But about 3.7 billion years ago, the Earth kind of calmed down. All the rocks got used up. We were no longer a metal duck in a shooting gallery. And within just a few hundred million years of that, there was life on Earth, maybe shorter. So it didn't take very long. There was a British theoretician, Fred Hoyle, very well-known theoretician, actually did a lot of good work, but he also said a lot of things that weren't true. He didn't believe in the Big Bang, although he gave the Big Bang its name. He was using it as in a derogatory sense in a BBC interview in 1949, I think it was. He said, yes, this idea, the universe originated in some sort of Big Bang, right? And everybody loved the term. I'm sure he didn't like the fact they did. But anyhow, he said, look, the idea that you could spontaneously generate life on this planet by just having all these oceans sitting around cooking up this primordial soup and doing the chemistry and eventually you get something like DNA, he says it's not probable. In fact, he did a little calculation and he figured that the chances that it would cook up DNA that way were about the same as the chances that a tornado whipping through a junkyard will assemble a 747. And as you know, that's only happened 2 or 3 times, so it's not very probable. Okay. Well, he was probably wrong about that because it looks like life got started very quickly on the Earth. And unless we're very, very lucky and just won the lottery, always possible, that means that, you know, life's not so improbable. It got started very quickly. It's like walking into a Las Vegas casino, putting a quarter in and winning some sort of jackpot on the first go. Must have been a probable bet. Not must, but likely was. Okay, anyhow, we'd like to know. We think that there's a lot of life out there. One way to find it is to say is just to go to these places, and if NASA's budget doesn't, you know, continually get squeezed, then we will do that. And that'll happen by the year 2015, 2020. We'll start bringing rocks back from Mars, look at them in the lab. Maybe we'll find life that way. The second way to find it is to sniff it out. And this is another project that NASA has, although it's on hold now, again, for budgetary reasons. The idea is that you can build a kind of telescope that can go out into space and look at some other stars that are also known to have planets. They're like, you know, there are hundreds of them now, by the way. And look at the light bouncing off their atmospheres and look for things like oxygen or methane or some other things, carbon dioxide, water vapor, whatever. Now, water vapor, carbon dioxide are not so unusual, but if you found oxygen, you would be sort of surprised. You know, there's a lot of oxygen, you know, like, you know, what, a quarter to a third of the air in this room, not now, but before I started speaking, was oxygen, right? Right, where did all that oxygen come from? Is it just here? I mean, when the Earth was born, oxygen. Hey, oxygen's a pretty good thing for you. But it wasn't such a good thing for life, actually, when it began to appear. It's actually a fairly new arrival. About 2 billion years ago, the oxygen began to, oxygen levels began to increase because you had all these little green microbes, this blue-green algae, just bacteria, really, and they would breathe in carbon dioxide and breathe out oxygen. Remember, you know, sophomore high school biology, plants breathe in carbon dioxide and they breathe out oxygen. So they're breathing out all this oxygen. For a long time, all it does is rust all the, you know, all the iron in the ground, you know, this great Virginia clay, and all sort of reddish stuff. That's the result of all this oxygen sort of, you know, turning the iron into rust. But after a while, it sort of, you know, rusted all the iron and then just built up in the atmosphere, which was a bad deal because, as you know, oxygen is very aggressive element. If you own a car, you know it's very aggressive because your car slowly gets turned into iron oxide thanks to the oxygen. Okay, just rusts away. But and for critters, it's actually pretty aggressive too. But if you can learn how to use oxygen as we did, then you have a better lifestyle because, you know, your metabolism's a little better. Anyhow, if you found oxygen in somebody else's atmosphere, you would say, hey, look, life, or at least, you know, blue-green algae kind of life. Doesn't mean there are any thinking beings there, but oxygen would be very unusual to find in somebody's atmosphere. So that's another project you could do. If you could find methane. Methane, there's some methane in this room, and it is on Earth mostly due to what are politely called bovine flatulence or porcine flatulence, right? Pigs, cows, they make quite a bit of methane. That's why you should never smoke behind a cow, I guess. Never done it, but, you know. Anyhow, so, you know, if you found methane, you could say pigs in space, right? If you found it in the atmosphere of some other planet. So that's another experiment. Now, unfortunately, as I say, it's kind of on hold, but assuming that, you know, this is all all has to do with politics and not with science so much, but if the politics get more favorable and some money is thrown at these projects, then you know, you might have a chance of that happening by 2015 or 2020. So that's horse number two. Horse number three is SETI, looking for intelligent beings. Now, the advantage of looking for intelligent beings is they might make it easy for you, right? Now, first off, the question is, well, do you expect intelligent beings to even occur, right? Look at the history of life on Earth, which may be at least 3.5 billion years, and it may be closer to 4, but anyhow, 3.5 billion years, and only in the last couple of 100,000 years did we get anything that was clever enough to attend UVA, right? And why did that happen? And how probable is it? I mean, that rock that wiped out the dinos 65 million years ago, had that arrived at Earth's orbit 20 minutes earlier, you wouldn't be sitting here suffering through this. There would be dinosaurs in Charlottesville, right? Now, some of you may think there still are, but you know what I'm talking about. You know, the dinos were doing great, 150 million years worth of dinos, right? Now, it occurred to me that, well, yeah, but the dinos would have evolved into something that was clever, and you would still be sitting here, but there would be big holes in the backs of these chairs so you could get your tail through, but otherwise you'd still be suffering through this talk. Well, no. I mean, that's not clear. I asked an evolutionary biologist about this once, and he said, well, look, Seth. He said, the dinosaurs had 150 million years to get smart and didn't. What would another 65 million years have done for them? Right? So it's unclear, you know, that whether just because I give you a million worlds with life, how many of them are ever going to produce anything as clever as you? That's a big research, well, it's not a big research topic, probably should be, but it is an interesting research topic, and there are people who work on that. And it's unclear what the answer is, although the evidence such as there is by looking at things like dolphins and other simians and things like that seems to suggest that, well, intelligence has certain survival value if you're in the right ecological niche, and it may just happen. One guy down at the University of New Mexico, Jeff Miller is his name, he's a kind of clever guy. He thinks that the reason we got smart wasn't because of tool use or anything. It was dating behavior of our ancestors. And since some of you may be interested in dating behavior, I will relate this story. Jeff Miller's theory, here it is, told as he would never tell it, of course. He said, look, there's a reproduction strategy in nature, a lot of higher critters do this, called, what is it called? It's choosing a mate on the basis of fitness, okay? In other words, here's the canonical example might be the peacocks, right? You know that the peacocks, the males, have these big blue-green feathers, right? And the female ambles into view and they show all these feathers. And, you know, the peahens sort of look them over and say, well, you know, those are pretty good, although this guy over here, he has actually better blue feathers, and he's the one that gets taken home to mom. Now, you might wonder what the advantage is for this peahen to have taken that guy with the big blue feathers home, right, rather than the other guy. Well, the advantage is that guy, it's hard to grow all those blue feathers, right? I mean, you know, if there are too many mutations in that guy's genome, he's not going to get those big blue feathers. So what she's really selecting for is lack of too many mutations in the genome so the chicks will be healthy. Right? Had nothing to do with the feathers. In fact, the feathers are probably a disadvantage. You know, all the big blue feathers probably attract predators, right? The fact that he's even walking around is already amazing, right? So this guy must be good. He's avoided all the predators, and he's able to grow those big blue feathers, right? So this selection for fitness, right, she chooses that guy. So he has developed this strategy of growing these big blue feathers, which don't help him in his daily peacock life at all, except to get a mate. Right? Now, you might say, well, yeah, but how does that apply to us, because we don't have big blue feathers? Well, it's the same deal. Of course, the women are making all the decisions on reproduction. And so, you know, it's said that men are merely a genetic experiment being run by women. And there's undoubtedly truth in that. But we don't have the blue feathers. However, it turns out we do have one part of our body that is highly tied into the genome, and that is your brain, right? About half of your genome has some influence on the way your brain gets wired up. So his thought was, well, our ancestors, before we came Homo sapiens, what the guys would do to impress the females would, you know, they'd go to parties. You know, they'd take off their crania and they'd pass their brains around to all the females. Hey, check it out, right? Not because they were interested in the women weren't interested in these guys' brains per se, but if the brains were wired up correctly, then they would assume that the genome didn't have too many mutations and the offspring would be healthy. Okay. Well, of course, passing your brain around at a party is considered a social faux pas. So that isn't actually what happened. What happens is that if the guys can, you know, tell a good story. This sounds self-promoting, but I really can't tell a good story. I can tell a good story, you know, they can sing, tell jokes, whatever, right? That the women were paying attention with their ears, not because they care whether this guy was clever or not, but if his brain's wired up correctly, that's pretty good. So what was happening is that the females were selectively choosing guys whose brains were wired up correctly, and they were ratcheting up the IQ of these guys, right? Now, they didn't care whether the guy actually was smart or not, but inadvertently they were ratcheting up their IQ. And the first question that comes to mind, of course, is, so how did the women get smart? And the answer is, well, there was a lot of selective pressure on the women to be interesting and charismatic too, because otherwise the males would sort of wander off, right, and find some other female and not bring back, you know, the mastodon meat or whatever to the offspring of female number one. So there was a premium on being clever and keeping the guy amused. All right. Now, not everybody agrees with Jeff Miller's theory. A lot of people don't, but it's appealing to me. It seems so, it's like, you know, one of those theories that sort of makes sense. And Miller himself will say, if you doubt me, he said, all you have to do is pay attention to people at Lord Hardwick or some other restaurant. You know, look at the couples. And if they're, you know, just getting to know one another, the guy's doing all the talking to impress the woman. Right? But if they've been together for a long time, the female's doing all the talking to keep the guy from wandering off without paying the bill. So, and this seems to hold true, so, you know. Anyhow, all right. But my real point here, other than, you know, the possible amusement value, the possible amusement value in this story is that this is a mechanism that if it's true, and as I say, there's some debate about that, but if this is true, this is the kind of mechanism that would work in, you know, lots of species. There's nothing very special about this mechanism. And so what he's saying is that, you know, the evolution toward intelligence might be a very common thing. All right, so how could you find them? Assume they are out there. I mean, all you can do is make these kind of hand-waving arguments until you find them. Well, there are lots of ways you could try and find them. One way is, of course, just to do what they do every night on TV and get in a rocket and go there, right? Star Trek, all right, Mr. Scott, you know, put the pedal to the metal. Let's go warp 6 and go visit somebody. Well, that turns out to be hard. As you know, the distances to even the nearest stars are daunting, right? We build rockets that go, you know, 7 miles a second, which is great if you're going to Earliesville, although it's unclear why you'd want to. And it's not even so bad if you're going to the moon or Mars, right? You can get there in a couple of weeks, a couple of months maybe. But to the nearest star at that speed takes you 75,000 years one way. And I submit to you that that's longer than you're going to want to sit there with your tray table and seat back in their fully upright position. Right, you're not going to want to do that. Now, you're thinking, oh, yeah, well, of course, but we'll just build faster rockets, and we will. But there's a real problem with the physics here in the end. There's an energy problem. If you want to get to the nearest other star, Alpha Centauri, 4.5 light years away, that's what? It's like 25 trillion miles, right? That's about what I have on my Honda. If you want to get there in your lifetime, right, you need to go at, you know, something like 10, 20, 30% the speed of light. And you can just, if you've taken high school physics, 1 half mv squared, just work out the energy. Forget the relativistic corrections. Just work out high school physics, the energy required to do that. How big a mountain of coal or how much gasoline or anything else that you're going to use to fire this rocket, how much of that you would need. There's a real problem here, real problem. In fact, the amount of energy required is comparable to the total amount of energy that the United States will burn up in the next couple of centuries. It's a lot of energy, right? So this is really hard, at least for us, very hard. So that's not on, not for us, maybe not for them either, by the way. But so we're not going to go there, not to the other stars where you might find ET. The second approach is just to wait for them to land on the lawn and ask to be taken to some leader or other, right? Approximately 1/3 of the American public believes that this is happening. I don't know, I presume 1/3 of you believe that too. That, yeah, there's a guy who says, okay. Well, Amro, I hate to tell you this, and I'm glad that the airline ticket is already paid because I don't believe it. I don't believe it. It would, look, you know, it would benefit me if they were here. If they were here, that would be job security for me, right? But 1/3 of the American public, and this has been true, by the way, since the 1960s. I'm sure there's a thesis in it. I'm sure there's several theses in this in which you know, sort of look at why it is that people want to believe this in view of the fact that there isn't very good evidence for it. Okay, but they like to believe not only that they're here, but that the feds, who are always malevolent, the feds are keeping you from knowing the news. Now, let me just say a few things about this, since, as I say, probably 1/3 of you think this is true. To begin with, This idea is, you know, this is not something of the last year. This has been going on since the war, that people see things in the sky and they think that some of them are alien craft. There's a guy actually who lives here in Charlottesville, who works in the emergency room in one of the hospitals, Stephen Greer. I occasionally have to debate him on the radio. And he's absolutely convinced, or at least he says he is, that they're here and they're in touch, and he's got protocols on what to say to them when they land in Charlottesville. When they do land in Charlottesville, I hope you'll let me know, because, as I say, for me, it's important to know. But the evidence mostly consists of people seeing stuff in the sky that they don't quite understand. There are thousands of reports like that every year. But, you know, people see things in the sky. They don't know what they are. I don't doubt that. Many of the people that make these reports are reputable. They're airline pilots. Heck, Jimmy Carter saw a UFO, right? He's reputable, right? It turned out to be Venus, but at least it was extraterrestrial, right? And you grant them that. I mean, that isn't the issue, that they've seen something. The question is what they've seen, right? Roswell, the Roswell incident, right? The aliens have come hundreds, maybe thousands of light years to Earth, and in the last 500 feet, they make a navigation error and crash into the New Mexico desert. This is like making a cross-country trip in your car and then totaling your vehicle on the garage door as you pull into the driveway. I mean, that strikes me as a little unlikely, but never mind whether it's likely or unlikely. There's a perfectly good explanation for what happened in Roswell that doesn't involve aliens, but it's not nearly as interesting for Fox Television, for example, to talk about the fact, well, actually, aliens didn't crash at Roswell. And in fact, from Roswell's point of view, and I happened to have been there a couple of months ago, it's the best thing that ever happened to that town, because who would have ever heard of Roswell, New Mexico? Thanks, you know, the Chamber of Commerce, I think they probably have a shrine to the aliens somewhere there, because this has been terrific for the local economy, and they're talking about putting a whole amusement park there. But I don't think that the aliens really crashed there. I think that the problem is this. If you go to the science museums up on the mall and look around for UFO exhibitry, there isn't much. In fact, I suspect there's none. And it isn't because you're not interested, right? It's because the evidence isn't very good. Something like 7% of the population, by some estimates, think that the aliens have abducted them for experiments that probably aren't appropriate on a first date, right? Now, you know, but there are terms, if you talk to psychologists, it's a perfectly good explanation for these experiences that they're having. And it doesn't mean that these people are crazy or lying or anything like that. They're misinterpreting a phenomenon known as sleep paralysis. That's what they say. I'm not a psychologist. Okay, so I would put it to you this way. All that needs to happen for me to change my mind on this is for somebody to come into my office with an ashtray or a radio knob from a UFO. Hey, Seth, look at this. That's all it would take. Wouldn't be very hard, right? But that never happens. Okay. The other thing is, as an analogy, I mean, you know, I think of Columbus, 1492, Columbus discovers America. Well, at least he lands in America, or actually in the Caribbean somewhere, probably Watling Island, nobody's sure. But anyhow, he lands there, right? Now, if you added 60 years to that, because it's been 60 years since Roswell, right? That was 1947. Add 60 years to that, so that's what, 1552. And now you ask the Native Americans of North America, the Indians, you say, well, do you think you're being visited by Spaniards, 1552? Do you think they would scratch their heads and say, well, we're not sure. About a third of us think so, but two-thirds are unsure. It is the subject of late-night talk radio, but we don't really know. They wouldn't say that. They knew perfectly well they were being visited, right? In fact, a third of them were dead or whatever, right? There were Spaniards all up and down the coast of the Americas. There was no doubt. The Spaniards did not come to North America and sail 3 miles offshore for 60 years to tease the Indians. Oh, are they there or are they not? You know, what did you see, Longfellow? Was it a ship or not? You know. So I don't think they're here. As I say, the other thing that you might... want to use as an argument one way or the other about this is there's always the question, if they're here, why are they here now? Why now? Why now? Are they here to protect us from ourselves? A lot of people say they're here now because of what we're doing to the environment, global warming and whatever, we're going to destroy ourselves, nuclear war, whatever, you know, whatever the cause celeb is of the day, and they're here to save us. Well, to begin with, I wonder at the sociology of that. I mean, now, mind you, the what we know about the sociology of aliens isn't a whole lot, but... Nonetheless, I mean, do you go out in the backyard and try and separate the ants to keep them from having these little wars? Right? Oh, look, you ants, it's going to be bad for you. You don't care about them, right? So I'm not sure the aliens would come here and help us out. But even if you think they would, how would they know that this is happening? Right? Maybe, well, they saw those nuclear blasts in 1945. right? Or they picked up I Love Lucy and they see we're in trouble. Or maybe they picked up Mr. Ed and they're here to take our horses and leave us alone, right? Save the horses. Then they'll come to Albemarle County maybe, huh? I don't know. But see, all of that is stuff that's only happened in the last 50, 60 years. We've only been sending signals out into space, radio mostly, television, FM radio, and radar, for the last, you can argue about the number, but it's on the order of 60 years, 65 years. That means anybody farther away than 65 light years from Earth doesn't know you exist. And if you can add up the number of stars in that within that distance, it's a few thousands, okay? But that's a pretty small number. The chances that ET is in the nearest, 10,000 stars strikes me as fairly low. So I think it's a safe bet that nobody in the cosmos knows that Homo sapiens exists, except other Homo sapiens and everybody else on this planet, right? Only we know we exist. So if they're here now, I'm rather surprised. All right, well, that's one way you can find them. There are things like crop circles and so forth. I won't even go into that. The idea, I just try and picture an alien parliament here. 100 light years away. Okay, Senator Zork, let me get this straight. You want to spend 600,000 galactic cruceros, build this giant spaceship, go 100 light years over to that little yellow star over there, find the blue planet around the star, and then go down onto that planet and carve graffiti in their wheat, right? I think it's unlikely you would vote for that, and they won't vote for it either. So, that's all of a piece. So enough said about the idea that they may be here. I don't think so, but if you have contrary evidence, I'm always willing to listen to this. The third way to find them, of course, is to do what the SETI Institute does, and that's to try and find them in situ, find them at home by just eavesdropping on their broadcast, radio. They may be flashing lights at us. We have various kinds of experiments. We've been doing this now since 1960. The first experiment was done in 1960. That's a long time, right? That's 47 years. Okay, Frank Drake did that first experiment not too far away from here, actually, in the Deer Creek Valley of West Virginia. There are some radio telescopes over there. It's a three-hour drive from Charlottesville. You might want to go over there. They're headquartered right here on Edgemont Road, not far from where you're sitting. Anyhow, he did that experiment in 1960, and people have been doing it ever since, not continuously, but they've been trying to eavesdrop on ET. And people often ask, well, Seth, so have you heard anything? I find it a peculiar question because if the answer were yes, I wouldn't be here. I'd be in Stockholm collecting a prize or something, or my boss would, in any case. No, we haven't found them. But usually the second question is, well, are you close? Now, that's also a peculiar question, really. How do you know? I mean, that's like asking Chris Columbus 2 weeks out of Spain. All right, Chris, have you found any new continents? No. Are you close? Well, I don't know. I mean, with just water around the ship all day today, just water. And by the way, yesterday, all around the ship, there was water. And the day before that, the environs of the ship were fairly aqueous. He doesn't know. And we don't know either. And then one day, suddenly he sees palm fronds or something, and he says, well, it looks like we're close to land. So you can't say whether you're close. I mean, this is a one-bit experiment, right? Maybe it's like pregnancy, You're not pregnant? Okay, but are you close? Doesn't make it. Maybe on Saturday night you're closer. I don't know. But in any case, so we can't say whether you're close or not. However, I will nonetheless bet all of you, and this I do routinely, so I'm a little worried about it now, but I will bet all of you a cup of Starbucks that we will find them by 2020. Only, not because, you might think, well, that's only another dozen or, what is it? That's almost 18 years, whatever it is, right? That's not so long. You've been doing this for 47, you haven't found them. What makes you think that the next 18 years might be any different? And what's different is that Moore's law that I told you about earlier, that the speed of your computers doubles every 18 months for the same investment. It turns out that the SETI Enterprise also doubles every 18 months in terms of speed, not in terms of results, obviously, but in terms of speed, because it is it's a digital electronics problem. Okay, so, in fact, This has been true. You can plot some index of how fast we're doing this search, and it turns out it doubles every 18 months, and that's been true since 1960, and it will continue to be true. In particular, the SETI Institute, which is, as I say, where I work, together with the University of California, Berkeley, which is on the other side of San Francisco Bay, is building a new telescope in California. It's called the Allen Telescope Array because Paul Allen, I don't know if there's a name known to you, but he's a co-founder of Microsoft. You know about Bill Gates, but there was another guy, Paul Allen, who was a co-founder. Paul Allen has contributed the money to get this thing started. Now we just need the money to finish building it. But in any case, if this thing gets built, and for the propeller heads in the audience, it'll be a 350 small antennas, each about 20 feet in diameter, spread out over some lava fields in northeastern California. That it'll be capable of doing this experiment 24/7, and it will speed up the search by 1,000 times. I think that this is the instrument that you actually need. I'm not surprised we haven't found anything so far. The total number of star systems we've looked at so far is on the order of 1,000. That's not the right number. 1,000,000 might be the right number. And this instrument could do that if we could get it built. So that's why I'm optimistic that we may find them. I'll be happy to talk about it at any level about the instrumentation, but I know most of you are not in technical fields, so I won't bug you with that. I will move on just very briefly and say what it would mean to you, the car buyer, if these predictions were true and we actually did find ET, say, by 2025, because, of course, you're going to be around for that. Well, to begin with, I mean, would we even tell you? Right? A lot of people say, yeah, so, Seth, if you guys actually found a signal, would you let us know? Or would the government even let you let us know? Because they figure this is very analogous to the UFO crowd, by the way. If you come back to the UFO folk and say, look, why is the evidence so poor? And they'll say it's because the government is keeping it from us. Right? And so I always ask, why would they do that? And the answer is because you couldn't handle the news. Right? And I find that a very peculiar argument, because one-third of you believe that the aliens are here, occasionally abducting you for unauthorized experiments, and you don't seem to be upset about that. So if we were to pick up a signal, do you think that the government would come in and shut us all down? 10 years ago, in 1997, we actually got a signal that for 16 hours looked like the real deal. And it was very interesting. Nobody went home. Nobody went to bed. Nobody went to In-N-Out Burger to get something to eat. We just sat there in front of the computer screens. And I kept looking around for guys from inside the Beltway to come in and shut us all down. They never showed up. The mayor of Mountain View, whom I knew personally, he didn't even make a phone call. No interest from the government whatsoever. But the New York Times did call. And, you know, one of their science reporters, Bill Broad, called up and he said, well, Seth, what about that signal you're following? It turned out it was interference from a European research satellite. Always the Europeans' fault, of course. But anyhow, but it was interesting to see. Interesting to see that, you know, there was no panic. People didn't go nonlinear. People didn't say, well, Marge, they're about to find aliens. I think I won't go to my work today. I'm going to riot in the streets. That won't happen. You will simply know about it. And there's no danger. Right? You tune in your favorite DJ here in on the radio, and you don't worry that he's going to jump into the back seat and start molesting you. He doesn't know you've tuned him in. Right? Same will be true here. You tune in somebody, and nobody knows. Now, of course, you could say, well, yeah, but they're going to hear I Love Lucy soon enough, or maybe somebody will broadcast something back to them. Maybe Muammar Gaddafi will broadcast something back to them, and we'll all be in danger. Well, I don't worry too much about that. To begin with, they're very far away. And secondly, if you're really worried about that, you should shut down ABC, NBC, and everybody else, because they are broadcasting to the aliens right now as we stand here or sit here. So you will hear about it. And then what happens? Well, what will happen is probably you'll build the bigger instrument. I think money will no longer be a problem. You build the bigger instrument, go back and look for the message. And either you understand the message or you don't. If you do, it could be quite interesting because, and this is a statistical argument, but it's a very good one, any message you pick up is coming from a society that's way ahead of us. Right? They're not at your level. This is something that's always wrong with the Hollywood films. Whenever the aliens come to Earth, we can always take them on in dogfights or whatever. Right? That's not going to be the case. If aliens really did come to Earth, it would be Bambi meets Godzilla, and we're not Godzilla. Right? So, but as I say, that's just a statistical argument. So if you can understand what they're broadcasting to you, well, here's how to get along, here's all of chemistry, here's all of physics, here's all of astronomy, here's a cure for death, here's whatever. Right, all this stuff. And that's going to change your gusto-grabbing, free-loving lifestyle when you suddenly get all this advanced knowledge. That's one scenario. The other scenario, which I think is more likely, is that you won't understand any of it because you just can't. Right? It's sort of like giving the output of your computer modem to a Neanderthal. You know, the Neanderthals weren't all that stupid, but they don't have the context to understand what you're talking about. Right? It's like trying to get, somebody was saying the other day, get slugs to appreciate Mozart. Right? They can feel the vibrations, but they don't get the art. Okay? So I think that that's more likely to be the case. But nonetheless, I think that it will be very interesting to get that message, simply because it shows that you're not the only kid on the block. We're not the only game in town. What would they be like? Are they going to be little soft, squishy gray guys with big eyeballs, right? No hair, big brains, no sense of humor, no names, no pets, whatever. Now, the way they always are in the movies, well, those are all projections of what we think we're going to become, of course. When you think about those little gray guys, you know, that's what we think we're going to be a million years from now somehow. You know, we're losing our hair. Well, these guys have lost all their hair, right? We're losing our olfactory sense, our dentition. These guys always have small nose, small mouths, and big eyes, because presumably a million years from now, everybody will be designing websites or whatever. I don't know. So it's just a projection of what we think we're going to become. It has nothing to do with what the real aliens would be like. I think that it's much more likely if you pick up a signal, given what I said at the beginning of this talk, it's not from soft, squishy aliens anyhow. It's from some sort of machine intelligence. And it may turn out that biological intelligence is a very brief phase you go through until you invent machines, and then, you know, after that, the soft, squishy guys are only interesting from an historical perspective. That may be. We won't know. But I think just knowing that somebody is out there as clever as we are, I think that that's interesting because for 500 years, astronomers have been pounding you on the head telling you, you're not special. 500 years ago, we thought the Earth was the center of the universe, right? And then, you know, Copernicus comes along and says, well, actually, he moves the center of the universe to the sun. And not very far, 93 million miles. Everybody gets upset, right? You're not special. And then it turns out, well, actually, the sun and all these other stars in the sky, they're all the same sort of thing. So the sun's not the center of the universe either. Not special. At the beginning of the 20th century, we thought that the entire cosmos consisted of one galaxy, and we were in the middle of it. And by 1920, we realized we weren't in the middle, and there were lots of other galaxies by 1929. Okay, not special. Well, you're human. You like the idea of being special, so we rationalize, and we say, okay, I get it. We're not astronomically special, but we're biologically special, or we're intellectually special, or maybe we're morally special, right? We're special in the eyes of God. We're God's children. Well, if you get this signal from space, you'll know that none of that is true either. Yes, we may be the children of God, but God has lots of other kids, and we'll be the youngest ones we know about. Okay, enough for my palaver. Maybe we'll take a few questions, if that'd be okay. Anybody conscious? I'll start with you, Anna.
So the X-Files, it was a show that aired on Fox for many years. I'm a large fan. And the central sort of trope of the show is that, you know, just the sort of conspiracy that you've, you know, kind of debunked here. Is the show still entertaining to you?
Is
the show still entertaining to you?
The show was always entertaining to me. I enjoy the show, but, you know, one should not confuse entertainment with truth. That's all, I guess. Yeah. Yes, sir. Yeah, good question. Would the alien life form, assuming it's biological, presumably, would it be carbon-based the way we are? And that's also a trope, actually, of sci-fi. They're always looking for carbon-based life forms, right? And you might think, well, yeah, but why carbon? Why not yttrium or molybdenum-based life forms? Actually, if you look at the chemistry of this, there's a good reason that it's carbon-based. Speaking of, there's a fair amount of carbon around. Actually, there's more silicon out here than carbon, right? You dig in the dirt, and you don't see silicon-based life. The reason for that is that carbon, if you study freshman chemistry, carbon likes to hook up with other atoms, right? It has these covalent bonds. It just likes to have buddies, if you will, other atoms. So it makes complex molecules. And life, in the end, is chemistry, right? Ronald Reagan, you won't remember, but he used to do the ads for the DuPont-sponsored Playhouse, whatever show it was. He said, better living through chemistry. He got it almost right. It's actually, living is chemistry. It's just chemistry. So you need these, you know, if you're going to talk about biology, you need these big molecules. And carbon is good at doing that, very good. It's better than anything else. And you look down the periodic table, and underneath carbon, you've got silicon, then germanium, and then, well, I think it's tin and lead, whatever. Okay? And they like to hook up with other atoms, too, but they're not nearly as good at it as carbon, because carbon is the smallest of these atoms, it turns out. So, yeah, probably carbon-based. It's a good bet. It doesn't mean that you can't have anything else, but if you want to be conservative, if you want to bet on the horse that seems to have the best chance of winning, carbon is it.
So, with that question, you kind of hinted at sort of evolutionary determinism. How similar do you think the evolutionary path, the extraterrestrials would take, would be to ours? Obviously, they did at a different point in that path, further down the path. Do you think that at some point they would have some sort of human-type ancestor or something that these
Yeah, the question is, how similar would the aliens' evolutionary path be to our own? And are you really asking, well, would they look anything like us, assuming they were biological, or Is that not really at the basis of you?
From the biochemical level all the way up to their
Well, from the biochemical level all the way up, I repeat these questions for the benefit of the podcast. In fact, nobody knows the answer to your question, I think is the answer to your question. We don't know the answer to your question. But let me point out that if you look, for example, at the chemistry, the biochemistry here on Earth, to begin with, it's carbon based. I think that that's, you know, that's going to happen a lot. I don't see any difference there. But for example, you know, amino acids are part of our biochemistry. There are many dozen amino acids around, but we only use 20 of them, really, right? Well, they might use a different set of amino acids, so that's going to make some difference there. I don't think that a ham sandwich would necessarily be something they would eat and get anything out of. So there would be details of the biochemistry that would be different. In terms of the evolution, you know, you read any of Stephen Jay Gould's books, and it shows you it's all contingency and so forth, and if you rewound the tapes of evolution on Earth again, everything would look different, you know. Yeah, it would, but on the other hand, it's not clear how far you should really take that argument, because there's a guy at Cambridge, I'll think of his name, but in any case, who studies these things, and it's his opinion that the aliens would look very much like us, because he says that we're actually a pretty good design for an intelligent being. Simon Conway Morris is the name, by the way. Simon Conway, you can look him up on the web. Simon Conway Morris. And he's written books. Now, mind you, he also has, I think, a theological axe to grind in this argument. But he's a guy who knows what he's talking about. He studied the Burgess Shale and so forth. And he thinks that our design is actually pretty good. I mean, you know, you want a head because that puts all the sensory organs in the processing power of the brain close to one another so you don't waste time getting the information from the eyes to the brain and so forth. One eye is good. Two eyes are better if you're a, you know, a thinking being because you've got to catch your dinner. And two eyes give you that stereo vision. You don't want them looking off that way, the way cows do. So cows don't have to do very much to get dinner. They just bend over, start chewing. But, you know, for you, that's a little harder. And so these kinds of arguments can be made. But I have to say that I'm not entirely convinced myself. I would be very surprised if E.T. was so recognizable that if you saw him walking down the colonnades here, you wouldn't think, what is that? I think you would think, what is that? Suddenly the archives. Yes, ma'am.
Ask the ill-doer question, I guess. If by 2020 you'll be buying a Starbucks because you detected the signal, but we can't understand it and they won't even know we're receiving it, what's the goal?
Yeah. Good question. Right. You don't get a cup of coffee, but we have found ET, but we don't understand them, and they, you know, don't know we're here, and so what's the point? I think that's a legitimate question, actually, and I tried to get at that at the end of the talk. Simply, I think it's very interesting to know whether what's happened here is somehow very unusual or not. If you find one other society out there, there are probably lots of them. It's sort of like going to Africa for the first time and seeing an elephant. It could be that's the only elephant in Africa, but that's probably the wrong conclusion to draw. Right? So, you know, I think that would tell you in an instant a couple of interesting things to begin with. What happened here is, you know, probably happened many, many times. So that's just interesting. The second thing is, you might say that because they're more advanced, we're hearing them, they're not hearing us necessarily, that at least that shows that we have some chance of surviving our technological adolescence, if you will. You know, just at the moment that you invent radio and that sort of thing that allows you to find them, you invent the H-bomb, which allows you to get rid of yourself. But these guys apparently have figured out a way to stick around long enough to get in touch. So maybe that's good news for mankind. I don't know. I mean, those are the sorts of things. But what you're really asking, because a lot of basic research is done not because of the payoff, but only because it's interesting to the people that are doing it. It turns out it always has some payoff. And here, I think that the payoff that people often tout is that you would work very hard on deciphering the information. And if you got information from a society that was 100,000 years beyond us, that would have lots of practical applications, I assume. Yes, sir.
On the topic of the Big Bang, are there any compelling theories, or what's your opinion on where the singularity came from?
Oh, okay. It's a cosmology question. Fundamentally, what was there before the Big Bang? I get this question occasionally from my niece. You know, she said, "Okay, Seth, what was there before?" She's an 11-year-old niece. You know, what was there before the Big Bang? I say, "Well, look, Becca, that's not a legitimate question because." You know, time came with the universe. I mean, you had this idea of the Big Bang. It was this big, empty room somewhere, right? And then, bing, something goes off, bam, right? And there's this big bang, and it starts, you know, spewing out all this stuff, which eventually coalesces into stars, galaxies, planets, and you, right? But that isn't the case. There was no empty room. Space is something the Big Bang created and is continuing to create, by the way. All right? And space and everything that's in it, including time. Okay. So before doesn't mean anything before the Big Bang. And she walks away and she says, I don't like your answer. Right? And it's true. It's not a very satisfying answer. And actually, the physicists don't like it either. These days, what is a trendy idea, but they're only ideas because nobody can prove any of this yet, is that, in fact, making a universe is not such a hard thing to do. It turns out that the total energy, mass and energy are the same, equals mc squared. You know, you can convert one or the other. This is despite what you learned in high school. Matter is neither created nor destroyed. Well, that was a bunch of malarkey, of course. But the total mass energy in the universe is zero. In other words, universes are free. I think Alan Guth called the universe the ultimate free lunch, right? It doesn't cost anything. And it turns out that, you know, it seems that if you were to twist time and space right here in this room the right way, you would create a completely new universe. Right? So it may be that if you just have the know-how, you might be able to do that, and it could be that this universe is merely the science fair experiment of a kid in another universe. I don't know how that affects your theological views, but there you go. Could be, but nobody really knows, and the current ideas are that there's sort of a meta-universe and you have these membranes, the string theory, these kinds of things that occasionally collide and produce big bangs, but that big bangs are very, very common. The reason you want big bangs to be very, very common, and that is to say that there are lots of universes, is because there is a problem with this universe, and that is it seems to be very finely set up for life. There's a problem that's been known for a couple of decades now. And what I mean by that is that if, for example, the constant of gravitation were a little bit stronger, a little bit bigger than it is, then the Big Bang would have collapsed in on itself and you wouldn't be here. Or if it had been a little weaker, it would have blown out so fast you never would have made stars, planets, and you, right? That's one example. That's kind of a trivial one. But there are lots and lots of these little things. And say, you know, why was the universe created just with the right parameters, or at least within a given range, so that we could be here to ask this question? And that's a very profound question, actually. One answer is simply to say, well, if it hadn't been done that way, we wouldn't be here asking the question, if you like that answer. Some people do. The other answer is to say, God did it, then you're done. The problem for the physicists is they can't write a lot of papers with that answer. Okay. The third approach is to say, actually, there are lots and lots of universes, and most of them are pretty crummy, and there's nothing in them that's alive, but this one is one of the good ones, because by chance, some of them will be good ones. Nobody knows the answer. If you know the answer, you know. Yes?
What's your take on the Fermi paradox, the idea that life is so likely and that, you know, given 30 million years, we should colonize the whole galaxy? Where are we right now?
Right. The gentleman asked about the Fermi paradox, first espoused at a lunch by Enrico Fermi, apparently Los Alamos, I think it was, in 1950. He was having a lunch, and he took a bite of his tuna fish sandwich and said, so where is everybody? And, you know, Fermi was thinking so fast. The point being, he had done the calculation that you alluded to, namely that the universe has been around three times as long as the Earth, right? The universe is, we know the age, or how long it's been since the Big Bang, and it's been 14 billion years, more or less. We know that to actually fairly high precision, believe it or not, which is astounding, because when I was your age, I had, and older, had a series of girlfriends who made a modest living by investigating the age of the universe. And they could never get it right within a factor of two. And now we suddenly know it to 2%. So maybe it's a good thing I stopped going out with them. I don't know. But the point is, what was the point? I lost the point here. The point is that the universe is three times as old as the Earth. It could have been actually, you know, 3 billion times as old as the Earth, but it's not. It's only three times as old as the Earth. But that does mean that most of the stars in the cosmos are older than the sun. So if there are, you know, societies out there, if this happens, if you actually do occasionally produce intelligent beings, then some of them have had billions of years head start on us. And if you can work out how long would it take an advanced society to colonize every star in the galaxy, it turns out, very naive calculation, it turns out it's on the order of 30 million years, for example, as you said. 30 million years is like that. It's sort of like once the Spaniards had discovered the Americas within, well, not 30 million years, but within 30 years, more or less, they were all up and down the coast of the Americas, right? The Spanish Main and so forth. Didn't take them very long at all. Once they got that underway, the colonization effort went very, very quickly. And so what Fermi was saying between two bites of his tuna fish sandwich was, there's been plenty of time for the aliens to have colonized every spot in the galaxy, and I don't see them here in New Mexico. So where are they? And this has become known as the Fermi paradox, and there are several answers to this. One is, well, they're not here because they're not anywhere, and we are the smartest things in the galaxy. Some of you will like that. It could be. The second possibility is that they are here and they know about us, but they've arranged things so that they can watch us because we're kind of amusing, but they've arranged things so that we can't see them. This is called the zoo hypothesis, right, for obvious reasons. And I think it's kind of cagey, but, you know, I don't know, they're letting us see everything else in the universe. But third possibility is that, you know, you just don't colonize the entire galaxy. If you think about it, all our colonization efforts, I mean, beginning, well, you can start with the Romans, but you can go back farther if you want to. I mean, you know, they could colonize the coast of the Mediterranean, but they didn't colonize the entire planet, right? The lines of communication become long, they get competitors, whatever. There are always various factors that always stop a colonization before it becomes, you know, takes over the entire place. The fourth possibility, I kind of like this. I'm just giving you samples. There are books written on this. Fourth possibility is that we're just in a backwater, right? I mean, you look at the Earth, and it's not uniformly inhabited. If I were to, you know, blindfold you, spin you around 10 times, throw you in a plane, and, you know, fly you around for 30 hours, and then land you, say, 20 miles outside of Winnemucca, Nevada, and then take off the blindfold, you know, you look around, and you say, well, I don't see any houses. I don't see any roads. I don't see any power towers. Nothing. I see rocks. You know, I don't know where I am, but wherever I am, this continent is uninhabited and uncolonized. It's a wrong conclusion based on a very local observation. I look in my backyard, and I don't see any giraffes, for example. And doggone it, giraffes have had plenty of time to walk to my backyard. And they're not there. But it would be the wrong conclusion to say there are no giraffes. Long-winded answer. One more question. Well, I think it ought to be this gentleman here.
Thank you so much for coming out. It really does mean a lot to this society. But you mentioned a lot about radio astronomy, and I was curious to see if there are any initiatives on SETI's part to use more laser-based technologies for transmitting signals, given the fact that radio might be too primitive for a lot of extraterrestrial societies.
Well, certainly listening to the radio in the Bay Area, it is fairly primitive. The question is, yes, what about laser technology and not just radio? To begin with, radio, although you may think it's primitive, you're judging it on the basis of the program content and not necessarily the technology. Actually, radio has seems to be the cheapest way to send one bit of information from one star to another in terms of the energy required. But your suggestion, why not we, you know, use lasers? Actually, we are looking for flashing laser pulses. There's an experiment being run by us at the Lick Observatory in California. UC Berkeley has an experiment. And if you go on the web, you'll find that actually the best experiments for this are being done up at Harvard. You could do this here at Leander McCormick, actually, with $10,000 worth of hardware. So looking for flashing lights from the sky, yes, it does make sense. I do want to say one thing. You suggested that we beam to them. Many of you may have the impression that we are broadcasting either radio or laser flashes into space. We do not broadcast. We just listen. Okay. Well, thank you very much.